Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate and Ryan here for another week of taxes, which might sound boring, but it's not.
Well, I mean, specifically, we're going to be talking about, you know, if you're running a small business or you want to start a side hustle or you want to structure kind of a long-term business, you really want to know how to do that. Is it a sole prop, an S corp, a C corp, a partnership? How do you do that? And when do you kind of roll out which levers to pull? And then how do you do it? And who do you talk to? And, you know, today we're not giving any tax, legal, or investment advice, of course. But we are going to have a friendly conversation just to get you thinking about the ways that you can sort of go down these roads. Because I've been reading the forums, and the forums say things like, you know, I really want to get into leasing my aircraft back to a flight school, or, you know, I started consulting. You know, how do I, what's the best way to minimize taxes for that? So that you're going to get those types of information in this podcast today.
Absolutely. And we always talk about, you know, so many pilots have side hustles or thinking about a side hustle as a way not only to potentially generate additional income, but in the first few years, maybe generate some losses that you can take against your W-2. So I'm reaching behind my desk. I have Toby's fourth edition of TaxWise Business Ownership. Fantastic book. We'll link to it in the show notes. We were talking about the fact that a lot has changed since he wrote that book, but I mean, Toby is just an absolute wealth. And today I really did want to get into business structure. So get into these side hustles, because this isn't something that we have tackled from an entity structure standpoint. How do you go about starting that lemonade stand, that pressure washing business, that consulting business, that aircraft leaseback business? How should you structure it? LLC, S corp, partnership, just like you said, Ryan, there's so many nuances to this, and how you structure your business really matters in terms of audit risk, in terms of the taxes that you might pay or avoid. So I'm super excited to get into it. I kind of hogged the mic a little bit on this one because I was so fired up. So with that, Ryan, what do you think?
Let's get to it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Toby, when I talk to investors all the time, I talk about the three, really there's only three avenues in my mind. I mean, we can get into some more advanced stuff, but there's really three main avenues that people can write off against their W-2 income. And one is become a real estate professional so that you can write off your rental property depreciation against your active income. One is short-term rentals, and one is starting a business. So today we really want to dive into the idea of starting a business. A lot of pilots have side hustles, and we want to get into the right way to do that. What you can write off, how to structure it, what businesses maybe offer the best opportunity to run expenses through that you would really need anyway. We hear a lot of people say, I got a business that basically does nothing. It has no revenue. I put my car in it. Now I'm writing off my life. It's like, yeah, you can't really do that. So let's start from the top. What would you say to somebody who wants to start a business or is just getting into it? What's the first step?
Well, you want to define what that business is and what your intent is with it. You know, there's a lot of things that you do at the very beginning that will have a pretty big impact on what the future of that business may hold. And let me give you an example. There's a small business capital gain exclusion that can wipe out millions of dollars of capital gains if you sell, but you have to structure it in a particular way right from the inception. And that's the qualified small business stock. And, you know, you're able to just $10 million or, you know, a multiple of your basis, you could literally sell a company and pay nothing in tax. So there's sometimes that. Maybe somebody has the intent to wipe out some of their income. So like you're mentioning, pilots that are high income folks, and they may not be eligible for active participation in real estate, or they may not be eligible for real estate professional status, or to using the short-term rental loophole. And they're like, okay, what are my other options? It's to start up a business. And then I would want the losses of that business. Let's just say that I'm starting up a pizza company, right? And I'm going to buy a bunch of ovens and other things. I might want that to hit my personal tax return so that it'll offset my highest tax brackets. You know, a lot of people think that it's a race to zero. I don't want to pay any taxes. And I would say, don't be that aggressive. You still need to be able to qualify for things like mortgages and stuff like that. But even more so is you have starting brackets, tax brackets that are 10 and 12%. Like, don't give that up.
Right.
Don't work your butt off to write off some dollars and just have it go after some low tax money. Make sure that it's, if you're going to use it, it's going at your highest brackets. And you might be surprised at how much control you have over that, by the way, of how much you recognize in a particular year and how you depreciate things. Hint, hint, you're going to hear a lot about that with the AI companies, since they're not accelerating their depreciation. They're taking it over time, so it makes the profits look better. You're going to hear about that. Just trust me on that one.
What is the AI company, for anybody that doesn't know?
Like NVIDIA. Like, you know, they're making chips and Palantir, some of these companies that are buying. It's probably more on the Palantir side than anything else, but it's maybe the Microsofts of the world and stuff that are investing heavily in assets that they're taking over a long period of time. And it makes their profitability look good, even though the cash is gone, right? And so you're going to see some of those. But on a micro level, as a person, I may want that loss, but I may not want to try to wipe out all of my income. I might say, hey, I'd really love not to have money in the 30s. You know, I don't want 35% tax. I don't want 37% tax. I want to offset some of those dollars. And you might be surprised at how much power you have over that, but it was really dependent on the type of business you set up. For example, you need a flow through business. So it's either going to be a sole proprietorship, do nothing. It's going to be a partnership. If you're working with somebody else, it's going to be an S corp.
Right.
If you are using a corporate structure, you would not want to use a C corp under those circumstances, for example. And that is where it really, you got to be sitting with somebody who knows what they're talking about when you're starting up your business, and you have to be honest about what are my expenditures going to be. And like you said, I don't just set up a family office that's doing nothing and write things off. I have to have a profit motive. Section 162, it's ordinary necessary business expenses. But I actually
hold on. I don't want to move on yet. I don't want to move on because you just made a huge debris field. Everyone's like, what the heck is he talking about? So first of all, you said something super important, which is starting a business and taking a bunch of tax write-offs against your personal return could impact your ability to get a mortgage. So I want to go very basic there. That's huge, because I assume that a mortgage broker or a mortgage lender might look at your personal return and say, you're not making any money because you have all these losses, and not understand that they're business losses that are tax efficient, but not necessarily mortgage qualification proficient. Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. It does have an impact on your ability to get traditional mortgages and things like that. There's also where the income or expense lands. For example, in underwriting, I may be an underwriter, maybe able to use 70% of the income that's showing up on page one of Schedule E, but paid 100% of page two, which means to somebody who's not familiar with accounting, that's the difference between maybe being a sole proprietor or a partner, or doing something in real estate, doing something in your individual name versus having it run through a partnership,
right?
Or in a business, making sure it runs through an S corp.
Absolutely.
So those types of things matter, and that's why you actually need to talk to somebody who knows what they're doing.
Real fast, I just wanted to mention, because we purchased a property in 2025. And we had taken a bunch of losses in 2024. And our mortgage broker said, hey, I don't even want to show the underwriter your tax return. We're just going to qualify straight W-2. So we're going to take all of the mortgages that you have and fit in within the DTI limit, the debt to income limit. And we were actually able to qualify. So for anybody that wiped out all of their income in their tax return, maybe it's, you know, they got it all the way down to zero and they paid no federal income tax. There are ways to qualify as long as you fit within the debt to income ratio. So just a pro tip there.
Yeah. And sometimes you can't shield that.
True.
So if you own a significant portion of your business, and that might not be shieldable. So if you're, you know, like in my case, you know, if I own more than 25% of a company, the underwriter, and I don't know all the rules, but my mortgage broker said, I have to show every tax return that you have because you own more than a significant part of your company. So you do have to put that forward. and that will count against. And now, I mean, I've got probably 95 tax returns
right
outside of my personal. So, you know, that could create some angst.
Yours are all flow through. I'm pretty certain. Like, you're not sitting there with a C corp that's kicking you out of W-2 and then you're taking a dividend. You're probably in partnerships and you're one of the general partners. I know your business, both. Right? So, yeah. So you have K-1s flowing down and they're going to, if you're greater than 20% owner, they're going to have to use that as a factor. Yeah. And again, that's why I say, is like, hey, I'm trying to build up my portfolio. I'm a real estate investor. I want to build it up. Then you need to make sure that you're saying to a, before you do anything, you're talking to your mortgage broker saying, what's important? What do you need to see?
There we go.
So Tate, yours is a case in point. You talked to your broker before they gave it to the underwriter. Had you given everything and that broker not known, you just, hey, I'm just applying for a loan. Blah, here's everything. You would have been denied. And once you're denied, it's almost impossible to get that loan. So you went to somebody beforehand. Yeah.
Precisely. Okay. I want to bring this back down to the basic level for, you know, I'm an airline pilot out there. I'm thinking, hey, I'm getting killed on taxes. I love, you know, the syndication space and being an LP in deals, but it's not going to get me the active W-2 write-offs. You know, I failed to mention there's also oil and gas, which, you know, is fantastic as well. But let's say I want to start a business and I want to be able to shift, let's say, my car, my cell phone, those basic things that I was going to buy anyway, over into a business. So let's first talk about what businesses, Toby, do you see that are accessible to the average person that you can do kind of on the side that are most advantageous for running typical life expenses through legitimately?
So the one that comes up for us all the time is creating your own family office to manage your portfolio. So you might have a LLC taxed as a partnership that is doing your trading business, and you have a corporation that is a partner in that partnership that is overseeing and managing that account. Then you have your real estate over here that is, if you're working with us, generally we're going to have a holding company holding the various LLCs that hold the various investments. And you have a C corp that is managing it all on behalf of your family. You may even put some side gigs in there that maybe are internet based. Maybe you're doing a subscription. Maybe you're doing a podcast. Maybe you're doing some things where you're like, hey, I have some other interests and I want to grow this. But realistically, it is managing the family portfolio. It is managing those assets for a legacy. You have a continuation plan of, hey, I want to build this up and I want my kids to be on the board and I want their kids' kids to be on the board and I want their kids' kids' to be on the board type thing. And that little family office is actually a really good tool because immediately we start looking and saying, all right, that office, there's an administrative office where they're doing their bookkeeping and their high level affairs. That's usually in your house. Okay, that allows me to write off a portion of my home. And I'm not talking about the traditional home office of the sole proprietor where it's $5 a square foot. No, you actually say, like in my case, I'm in my home office right now, right? And my company can reimburse me for the value of everything in this home. I'm talking about with cleaners, utilities, whatever. And you figure out what either use room methodology or usable square footage, the net square footage. And I'm going to get a proportionate amount. I'm going to get a percentage. So maybe it's 20%. Maybe this is one room out of really five rooms in the house. And I've dedicated it to an office. I can reimburse 1/5 of all the expenses. I don't have to declare that as income as an individual. The business can write it off. Then if I'm driving my car, and this is the one that kind of ticks me off because there's all these TikTok people and Instagram people saying, you know, buy your Range Rover at the end of the year. I'm like, psh, 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 psh. You know, you have to use it more than 50% for business. Otherwise, you're going to have a taxable event back to you. Or you just do the mileage reimbursement method and you just track it. Use like Mile IQ or one of the apps that tracks your mileage and reimburse yourself. It's usually, you know, 70 cents a mile or so. And you just, that's money that you don't have to show. Then you have, because you set up a actual formal business and you're meeting with your kids or whomever, it might just be spouses, it may be just business partners, and you have it in your house and you use something called 280A, which is the Augusta rule, and you say, hey, that for this particular meeting, I'm going to rent the house. And as long as you do it for 14 days or less, you don't have to include that as income in your return. And so the company can pay you fair market value of using a similar accommodation. What's a similar accommodation? Go to local hotels and ask them how much for meeting rooms and things like that. But that is free money. Like you, this is money that you're literally just moving from, hey, I would have paid tax on it, to it's in my pocket and it's a deduction, so I don't have to pay tax on it.
All right. That's a lot. And it's amazing. So we usually do this at the end, but I want to actually plug it here. So this is obviously something that nobody's going to go out and do that on their own. They're not going to listen to this podcast and go, yep, got it. Check, check, check. I'm going to go set all that up. So how do people get in touch with you and help get some guidance on how to create this structure?
Yeah, we do live events quarterly, probably six times next year. But realistically, the easiest thing for anybody out there is just go to the YouTube and type in my name.
Yep.
And you'll find my channel, subscribe to it. And it's easy. The other route is I can give you guys a link or something so that somebody could just go in and register. We do weekly events on tax and asset protection, and anybody could come. I welcome anybody out there listening. Please join us for a tax and asset protection event. We do them live on Saturdays for the most part, and then we do multi-day events four or six times a year, where Ryan oftentimes comes out and talks about the investments that Spartan does, things like that. They're just learning what your options are and then how to implement them should you see, hey, there's a benefit I could get here. And by the way, Tate, I just gave you like three or four of the top level ones. There are ordinary necessary business expenses. Like right now I'm on a computer. Write that off. The internet, write that off. The camera, write that off. You know, there's all anything that's an ordinary necessary business expense for your type of business. Traveling to an event, write that off. The meals while I'm there, write off. You can write
50%
off a portion, reimburse yourself a portion. But, or you're going to reimburse yourself, but you can only write off a portion. But there's so many different tax strategies that flow out of this. You know, I could spend hours, which we have, right, going over them. But it's just knowing, hey, that this is a world where I could get money back into my pocket. And a lot of this is I'm already spending, but I could get it back out to myself in the form of a deduction.
All right. Here are 10 top businesses that airline pilots are most likely to engage in, right? Most likely to engage in. And I probably engage in six of these, right? They're going to be consultants for or aviation training for flight schools. They're going to get involved in aircraft leasing or fractional ownership of airplanes. They're going to get into real estate, self-storage, multifamily, single family, syndications, et cetera. Airplane detailing, maintenance, or hangar services, right? They're going to have a hangar that they lease out. They're going to start their own 135 operation or aerial services like photography or, you know, something like that. They're going to get into pilot career coaching. So they're going to help people do interview prep or resume services. They're going to get into some kind of e-commerce business like Amazon or online stuff. There is a very popular surgence of people who do YouTube channels, podcasts, and aviation content creation to Tate's demise. I've seen some of your stuff that you've reposted, which is really funny. They're going to get involved in drone services companies, right? Part 107, they're going to start doing, you know, aerial photography with drone services. Or they might get into some kind of aviation software app development. Those are kind of, I think, like the most asked about, talked about, I've seen. So, I mean, I do like the family office concept, right? Where if somebody's like, oh my God, I've got, you know, 19 rentals and I'm, you know, I'm doing all this stuff. And like, that would probably be something like worth exploring to get into. But can we talk about like kind of the common stuff and see like what deductions there are, how you would structure, say, and we could just zoom in and pick one of these.
I love that. I was going to say like a pressure washing business, even, you know, something very pedestrian. So, which can be very lucrative as well. So yeah, let's pick one of these and dive in. And I've got a bunch of questions on the formation and the structure and the Schedule E versus Schedule C and all this stuff. So
I was going to say that the 11th one that I've seen a lot of pilots do, actually probably a half a dozen pilots that I know, is they buy a like FedEx trucking franchise, or they do some kind of Amazon truck delivery service, something like that, where they're running trucks and deliveries, and they do that pretty successfully. you know, or some kind of franchise restaurant, right? They might buy a, I know a guy in Atlanta that owns like a chicken restaurant, you know, or I can't remember what it's called.
You can buy a UPS store.
UPS store. Yeah, exactly.
So Toby, let's pick one of these and dive in. Which one?
Well, I'm going to just say you don't have to be mutually exclusive. So for example, when I say a family office, I just mean a management company that's doing the active business.
Yeah.
I could very easily, let's just say that you're going to do a pressure washer business. And the question is, do I want it to hit my return or do I not? Right. So let's say I have a management C corp. I could very easily set up an LLC in my local jurisdiction, my state, you know, so I'm usually going to recommend people that are doing the family office to use Wyoming because nobody can take it. Nobody can see it. But I might set up a subsidiary in my local jurisdiction where I'm doing pressure washing. Why would I do that? Is I don't want, you know, I hire somebody and they trip and fall while they're pressure washing and harm themselves. And the next thing you know, I have a lawsuit or I have an employee suit or, you know, fill in the blank, a breach of contract, or somebody says I destroyed their concrete on their driveway or in their walkway and they sue me for some exorbitant amount of money. Or that I harmed them when I was there, one of my employees harmed me. Like, we want to isolate that risk. So we would set it up perhaps as a disregarded LLC in that local jurisdiction, and then it would flow up into that main entity. That's if I didn't want it to hit me personally. Like, I want to expense out that money, and I don't want any more money going into my highest tax bracket. That's likely where I would go. But if I was just setting up a business, like if somebody out there is listening, go, Toby, shush kebab, I just want, what's the, like, if I'm setting up a business, then I would say, number one, do not do a sole proprietorship unless it's going to be super small and has no risk. Why do I say that? Because sole proprietors get audited about it's a multiple times. Last time I ran the numbers was 2019 was the last time the IRS gave us the data we needed to run it. And it was about 1,000% more likely to get audited as a sole proprietor. And you don't get the same benefits. Every dollar that you make is subject to employment taxes. It's just not a good thing. So we're generally going to be an S corp or a C corp when it's an active business. S corp is when the profits and loss flows down onto your personal return. C corp is when it's taxed at the corporate level and it stays there and it's 21% flat tax. So if I am expecting losses and I need those losses, then I would not be a C corp. I would be an S corp. If I don't think I'm going to have losses, but I think I'm going to have income, then the question is, do you want that to hit your return or do you want it to be taxed at that flat 21% and start building up some income over there? And I'll just tell you right out the gate that most accountants, when they hear C corp, they think double taxation. You're going to pay tax at the corporate level. And then again, as a shareholder, when those profits are distributed, I'm talking about a scenario where I'm not distributing the profits, where I'm really building my business up and I'm growing it, or I'm expensing it out every year. Like, there's so many different deductions you can get. For example, if I have a C corp, I can write off all my medical, dental, and vision, just reimburse myself. I don't need an HSA and all this other stuff. I can literally just reimburse myself, although you'd still set up the HSA because it comes out of your top bracket, right? But I'm reimbursing all my medical, dental, vision out of that C corp. Like, there's always these factors. And I'm sorry that it gets a little bit confusing and that there's not one right answer, but that's where I would start. I'd say, like, if it was you, Tate, I say, Tate, do you need this money? Are you going to be spending it? Do you want it to be at your tax bracket? And you might say, no, I have enough income. In fact, I'm getting killed in taxes. The last thing I want is more taxable income. And I would say, let's create a structure where it flows into an entity where we can get some tax relief to help us on our personal sides, things that we might be already incurring, some expenses you might be incurring, whether it be, you know, again, the home office, maybe it's 280A, maybe it's your equipment at home, things like that, that I'm buying it, but I'm not getting a deduction. Now we get a deduction. But we could also push money up into it and have it taxed at 21% as opposed to hitting me at 35 or 37%. And I'm like, okay, great. And then I can grow that. Now I have those funds available to myself to continue to grow whatever it is that I'm trying to do, whatever my endeavor is. So that might be the conversation. Or you say, no, Toby, actually, I need that money. Like, I'm setting this up because I need some extra cash. In which case I'd say, all right, Tate, if we did nothing and all you did is open this up and did it as a sole proprietor and you made an extra $20,000, what's going to be the tax hit on that, both employment taxes and federal and state, right? And then does setting it up and making just an S election, for example, like we could set up an LLC and have it taxed as a sole proprietor, but let's just say we made an S election on it. Is that going to save us money? And for a lot of people, it's pretty decent size.
An S election, just to be clear, S corp.
Yes. So I want to back up a little bit because people might be a little confused here. And I, you know, because we're talking C corp, S corp, sole proprietorship, LLC, all these things. Can we start with, let's start with sole proprietor, and then somebody starts an LLC, and then they make an S election, and then maybe they consider the C corp. So can we start with sole proprietor? Let's say I start a lemonade stand and I make $100 and I spend 50. I have $50 in profit. What happens to that? There's no entity structure whatsoever. And we need to differentiate between taxation and asset protection because those are two very different things.
All right. So let's say that I set up a lemonade stand, like you said, and we'll use the 100 and, you know, we're making $50. You would be taxed at the federal tax level that you are in. It would flow onto your return into your highest bracket, and you'd be taxed at that level. You'd be taxed at the state level. And then because you're participating in your business, it's you, you're going to be taxed under old age, disability, and survivors and Medicare at 15.3%. And then there's a phase out and a bunch of other stuff. So employment taxes.
What if it loses money, and how many years can it lose money before it becomes a hobby loss?
That's a good, really good question. So let's talk about that. You're talking about section 183, which is the hobby loss rule. Says, hey, you got to make money 3 out of 5 years or you're going to be considered a hobby. That's a presumption that says, hey, this isn't an activity engaged in for profit. And all it does is it says you can't take a loss on it. You can offset your income to the extent you have expenses, but if you have additional expenses and it creates a loss, you can't use those.
And this is, to be clear, you know, I wanted to ask this question because a lot of times when people are setting up businesses, they're saying, I want to write off against my W-2. I want to generate losses. I want to start a business that purposefully loses money, which you can do for a few years, but you can't just do it indefinitely.
Well, so there's cases. And I think the one that I'm thinking, I'm just going off of memory. I think it was 38 years. It was a music industry exec where he was trying to get his kid to make money in the music industry. And the guy just lost money every year. But he had an intent that he could demonstrate to make a profit. And so he won. So how many years in a row can you lose money? There's not a number. There's a presumption if you lose money 3 out of 5 years that you're not in it for profit, but it's a rebuttable presumption. In other words, it shifts over to you to prove that you're actually trying to make money. So if you're setting up a business like, oh, I just want to create losses, that's not a profit motive. I don't care. They could pop you in the first year.
So Toby, let's run through all of these in a profit and a loss situation. So in each case, we either made $100,000 in net profit or lost $100,000 in net losses. And how would that affect your personal taxes if it was sole proprietor, LLC, S corp, and C corp?
All right. So let's say you made $100,000. So it's Tate Inc. or no, just Tate Business. Lemonade stand really took off.
Right.
You made $100,000 and you're a sole proprietor. That's going to be taxed at your federal level under the gradual system, the tax bracket. So it's going to go into your highest tax brackets and continue to push you up.
And let's assume that I'm an airline pilot making $300,000 a year in a W-2.
And you're married?
Yes.
So it's going to be in the 30s. I think you're going to be, I don't know the tax brackets off the top of my head, but you're going to be, you're not going to be at 37%. You're probably going to be at some at 35 and just below that. But regardless, it's going to be taxed at the federal level. It's going to be taxed at the state level. And 100% of that money is going to be subject to self-employment tax, which could be as high as 15.3%. And the reason I say could be is because there's a phase out and then a phase in, depending on how much you make. So, you know, depending on if you're taking a big salary and it's you and it's not a spouse, then you may have phased out of a portion. It might be subject to 3.8% or 2.9%. If it's a spouse and it's their first dollars, they're at 15.3%. But the thing is that 100% of that money is subject to the self-employment tax. Switch it to an S-corp. in an S corp, you just have to take a reasonable salary, which most folks say, like, hey, rule of thumb is about a third of the profit. And then the rest of that, that distribution is not subject to self-employment tax, the Social Security taxes, payroll taxes, whatever you want to call it. So the entirety will still be taxed at your federal tax brackets and state tax brackets. But the money that is not salary will not be subject to the employment taxes. And that's why you see a lot of accountants immediately go to S-corps when people are setting up businesses, because they're like, hey, if you make $200,000, we don't want you to be paying, you know, a huge amount in employment taxes when we could avoid it by simply having you take a salary, and then we can avoid it. A C-corp making that same $100,000 is a flat 21%.
Right.
And it could be higher, could be lower than your bracket. Like if it's somebody who's not an airline pilot and they're making $50,000 a year, it may not make sense. For somebody who's making $500,000 a year, you're looking at it going that you're probably going to want a C-corp, because you don't need that money. Let it be taxed at a lower rate so it can continue to grow.
I love that. And I want to point out that there's no difference there, right, in sole proprietor versus LLC. And that's what so many people, I think, miss, is they think, oh, I need to save on taxes by setting up an LLC. It's the S election that changes the taxation.
So, yeah. So an LLC doesn't exist to the IRS. They just put their, they go like, ah, tell me what it
that.
Is.
Exactly.
Right. And you say, oh, just ignore it. Or it's a partnership, or it's an S corp, or it's a C corp. And by the way, you always start with C corp and then you make an S election. So it's, you're telling them, hey, it's a corporation. And then you make an S election on that. And by the way, anybody out there that's a sole proprietor who goes, crap, Toby, you're telling me something, I've been operating all this year, you can make a late election before the end of the year or even after the end of the year. There's a way to do it so that you're not getting killed in employment tax. But that's, if you're making money, 100,000, 100,000, 100,000, you could have an LLC and it doesn't matter that it's an LLC. You just tell the IRS how you want it taxed. So you could have an LLC that's ignored. It's going on your Schedule C. It's a partnership. It's going on your Schedule E. It's a S-corp. It's going on your Schedule E. It's a C-corp. It's not going anywhere on your return.
There we go. Thank you. That's what I really wanted to clarify for the audience, is the differences in how these things are taxed and how they're viewed in the eyes of the IRS. Excellent. Thank you so much.
And by the way, Tate, all of those, the asset protection is identical.
Right. Except for sole proprietorship. If you don't have any entity structure, you're out in the open.
You have an LLC.
Yeah.
And it's a sole proprietorship, you have protection.
Right.
If it's an LLC and it's an S corp, you have protection. If it's an LLC, it's a C corp, you have protection. If you just operate a business in your name, and as a sole proprietor, and there's risk, you're nuts.
Yeah.
Right. There's like, you could literally ruin your life over that. And I always use a plumber example. So I live in a house where a plumber forgot to put the pipes together, put the sealant on pipes, and a pipe opened up, did $1.5 million of damage. This is before I bought the house. I bought it after, of course. Good deal. But $1.5 million, well, that plumber was exposed to, they had to pay for that. Hopefully they had some insurance, but if they didn't, if it went over the insurance, like a lot of people are going to get $500,000 insurance policy, now you owe $1 million. You need to have a box around that. You got to make sure that doesn't come over and that they're not garnishing your flying wages, you know, as a pilot for the next 20 years. But by the way, they can do that. So you don't want to be in that situation where you have somebody following you around and garnishing. So you isolate it. That's why what we say with asset protection, there's inside liability. And then some people are worried about outside liability, making sure if I do something, get in a car accident, they can't take my stuff. But that's asset protection.
Can we run through those corporate structures one more time with a $100,000 loss?
Yes. Yeah. So let's go the same situation. I'm being taxed as a sole proprietorship, which means I did nothing, or it's an LLC that is disregarded to me personally. So I am a sole proprietor. It's going on my Schedule C. I would get, if I lost $100,000, I would have $100,000 lost on my tax return. If I am an S corp and it's me and I have basis, which means I'm at risk, I'm the one who put the money in, I get to take that loss. if it's a C corp and there's a $100,000 loss, I do not get to take that loss. The C corporation has the $100,000 loss. If I dissolve the C corp, then I could take the $100,000 loss. But just in itself, if I have a loss in that beginning phase of that business, it's either flow through and it comes onto my return, which is sole proprietors, partnerships, S corps, or it's trapped, and that's when it's a C corp.
Beautiful. Thanks for laying that out.
You know, I love the semantics around, you know, you set up a business and how much should you pay yourself? And, well, I'm going to set up an S corp and I'm going to pay myself $300,000 a year to run a YouTube channel that, you know, normally doesn't pay somebody $300,000 a year. Maybe it does if you have like 80 million subscribers or something, but you have 12 and you're like, I'm going to pay myself a bunch of money and I'm going to run this thing at a big loss, you know, just stuff like that. I wanted to kind of get into like a reasonableness test on compensation. So it's something I wanted to walk through. Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever you're dealing with reasonable compensation, I understand this. This used to be a hotbed when you had double taxation at ordinary rates in a C corp. In other words, a C corp used to get up to 35% tax bracket. I think it had a 39%, then it went down to back down to a 35%. But it was a huge tax bracket at the corporate level. And then you would have ordinary tax on the dividend. So companies would pay people huge salaries. And the IRS would say, that's not reasonable. That's really a dividend. And that went out the door when they changed it to flat 21% and they changed the qualified dividends to be taxed at your capital gains rates, long-term capital gains rates, which means it could be 0-15% or, you know, like it's going to be a smaller amount. But where you do see it is in S-corps where they say you're taking too small a salary. It's almost never you're taking too large a salary anymore. The IRS is happy to have you take a big fat salary because you're going to pay employment tax
right
on that entire amount, and you're going to be taxed at the highest level of taxation that's really out there, which is the individual rates. So they're like, go for it.
Right, because that basically balances itself out because you might be showing a loss in the business, but now it's going on to your right on top of your W-2 income, and you're back to paying high income tax rates, plus more Social Security, Medicare.
Let's go over two scenarios. If it's a C corp and you pay yourself a big salary, you're paying tax on something that you probably shouldn't, right? If it pays you a salary and it creates a loss inside the corp, that loss is trapped inside the corp, but I'm paying tax on that salary. So the IRS is like, congrats, do more of that.
Right.
Create lots of loss that you can't use personally and pay tax at the highest level. Where you do see it is on an S corp. And if you paid yourself a salary and it created a loss, yeah, they would offset. You would use the loss. Now, you're still paying employment taxes on the portion that you're paying yourself as a salary. So it's kind of a, hey, you probably shouldn't do that because you're going to end up paying more into, you know, employment taxes than you need to. But there are people that'll do that knowing that they're going to create a loss because they're putting it at a 401k or they're doing it in a defined benefit plan where it's going to have tax deferred growth. And they, as long as it's reasonable, what could I pay a third, you know, an arm's length transaction, third party, unrelated third party, what would I pay them to do this job? And that's usually what you're looking at. You go to salary.com or you talk to your accountant and they do a little bit of a test and they say, here's the range. And by the way, you know, depending on how extensive this business is, you may end up getting an opinion on it saying, all right, here's what we think are reasonable compensation amounts. But we don't see it come up that often in the small business realm. Usually it's, you can kind of eyeball it pretty quick. And the IRS, I'll just tell you that they don't audit S corps that often. It's, I think it was 0.01%.
Right.
It's a small amount. And where they do audit you is if you don't take a salary. That's the audits for S corps because they're mad. You're like, you're making money and you're not paying employment taxes. You need to take a salary. And when we see those cases come up, it's usually a third of the profit. So if somebody made $200,000, the IRS audits and says you didn't take a reasonable salary, they're probably going to force you to take $60,000, $70,000 in salary.
Right. That's excellent. What's the difference between Schedule C and Schedule E?
So Schedule C is where your is a trader business that is the individual. So husband and wife could qualify in some states, but it's your business on your schedule, is it on your 1040. Schedule E is all your business income and investment income.
Right. Active business income flowing onto your personal return.
Yeah. So you get into some weird situations. And again, I've gotten technical. I hope I don't lose your audience, but where you have somebody doing something like I'm a trader in securities, and they'll literally take deductions on Schedule C saying, hey, I'm a trader business, but the income is on Schedule D, which is capital gains. And you get these weird scenarios where they just walk people into audits. There's actually an accounting firm that's been doing this for 30 years, walking people into audits and then defending them and saying, we're really good at defending these audits. And I'm like, don't get audited.
Right.
Like, don't do that.
Right.
You look too attractive. But yeah, realistically, the way you look at it is Schedule E is where all your other, your S corp, your partnerships, your real estate, all these different business interests flow onto. If I'm an active business, it's going to go on Schedule C. And if I'm doing selling assets, it's Schedule D.
And this is what we're trying to coax people towards, is getting things off of your Schedule C, which means that you just have a flow through entity that the IRS ignores, and all of the business income is flowing straight onto your personal tax return. That's got a higher audit rate because the IRS assumes that, hey, if you're not sophisticated enough to put this in an S corp or a partnership, you're probably not doing your bookkeeping and accounting correctly. So we want to take a second look. Whereas, hey, if you put that over into an S corp and it flows onto your Schedule E, or a partnership, you get a K-1 that goes onto your Schedule E, it's much cleaner and it's much less audit risk, right?
Yeah. Not only that, but you can actually go look at the stats. When they audit, they were winning audits against sole proprietors at a clip of 94%. It was 93 and 94%, where they were just beating the snot out of them. And the win rate against, you know, partnerships and S-corps is in the 60s, right? It's not nearly as close, but they're also not auditing. They're auditing a fraction of the amount. Like, you know, it was 1.4% last time I checked. The last time they gave us the data, Schedule C's were audited about 1,200% more often than their counterparts, the partnerships and the S corp returns. So not only do you not get molested, but you don't lose as much when you do. But they were definitely just had their ears back. And what they said is exactly when you were talking in the beginning, hey, I set this up and I write everything off. They said people that do sole proprietorships are more prone to overstate their deductions than other businesses, because they're probably operating without the guardrails of having a professional saying, don't do that.
Bingo. So in that vein, let's talk about what is reasonable, ordinary, and necessary to conduct business. If somebody has a YouTube channel, can they write off their car? Like, because that YouTube channel doesn't require an automobile to get anywhere, right?
Well, it depends on what they're using their car for. Yeah. So like a car as a piece of the YouTube channel, no, unless they're doing a YouTube channel that where they're looking at cars or they're traveling, they're driving around, then you could say, hey, that car is being used in furtherance of the profit motive. Then, yeah, I could write off a portion of that vehicle. Assuming that I'm using it 100% for business, I could write the whole thing off. And I have two choices. I could write off the actual expenses. So I write off the car and the gas and the oil changes and all that, or I just do the mileage reimbursement. The problem is most people don't have a vehicle that is just for business and they're using it for personal. And I have to track the mileage no matter what, but you have to figure out what that ratio is. And if I take and I expense out a vehicle, so let's say at the end of this year, Ryan goes out and buys a Range Rover. And it's a $150,000 car, and he writes it all off because he says, I used it 100% for business. And the following year, he falls below and by the way, the reason I use the Range Rover is because it has to qualify as equipment. It's the
6,000 pound.
Yeah, gross vehicle weight. But otherwise, you're writing off a portion of it. There's specific rules for SUVs. There's specific rules for luxury passenger vehicles that restrict how much you can write off on an annual basis. But I'm using the TikTok clickbait G-Wagon. Right. Let's do the Range Rover. Now, if Ryan falls below 50% business uses the following year, the entire amount of the deduction that he took in the previous year is taxable to him. It comes back and is taxable. So these people go out there and they're like, just drive it at the end of the year for the last 2 weeks, buy it and use it for business and you can write it off. That is true. If you used 100% for business that year and you want to take that depreciation now, you can. But you fall below that 50%, it's coming back. And that's
the next 5 years.
Yep. Yeah. It's the next 5 years. Plus, even if you don't, you still have to pay tax on the personal use. And the IRS gives us a schedule and says, what's the value of the vehicle? How much do you have to include as compensation? So
can I interject real quick, though, and play a little bit of devil's advocate? How would they prove that you used it for personal use?
You have to put on your return. How much was business use and how much? Yeah. How
so
much,
if what? Ryan did no tracking whatsoever and he just, you know, he got dragged into an audit and they said, well, you know, show us how much personal versus business. He was like, I used 100% for business. Like, how do they prove that, you know, where that Range Rover drove?
You're required to keep a mileage log on any vehicle that you drive for.
So if you don't have any mileage log whatsoever, they're just going to disallow the entire thing?
Correct. If you don't have a mileage log, you've lost.
That's great.
Your burden as the taxpayer. And my experience is that most people don't keep a mileage log. Most people that do this and have the 100%, they just put a bullseye right on their forehead and they lose those audits. And it's not just losing the deduction. You get penalties and interest as well. So it can be a pretty nasty situation. And you're subjecting yourself to potentially even criminal exposure. So every now and again, they take somebody out of the line and they beat the snot out of them. Everybody else looks over there and goes, I don't want that to happen to me. And they get back in line. Right. And you don't want to be that case where they're like, hey, we want to send a message. And this is literally what they say is we don't audit that many people. But when we do, we want to make sure that we're sending a message to everybody else that this is what could happen so that you're not tempted to step outside the lines of what's legal. Again, we see this stuff day in and day out. You know, what people are willing to do and how to track. A business that has vehicles is going to have its people keep a log of what that usage is. And if they have personal use, they're driving at home and they're using it as commute. That is personal use, and they're going to track that and say, this is what portion of that vehicle is personal use to you. And it's no different than if I said, hey, Ryan, you did a great job this year. Let's say that Ryan and I work together and we're in the same company. And I say, Ryan, here's a brand new Corvette. That's taxable to him. I don't care how much it's being used for business, right? That's taxable compensation. Here you go, Ryan. If he wants to use it in another business, that's up to him. But that's still going to be taxable out of this business.
Let's bring it back to somebody that wants to start a business. I think Ryan and I sometimes talk about, you know, not putting the cart before the horse. People are like, oh, I got to make business cards. I'm going to start an LLC and I got to make a website. It's like, how about you just go out and make a sale, right? Like, let's bring it back to that pressure washing business. And we always say, just go do the thing. It's like, you want to buy real estate, buy some real estate and then put it in an LLC later. Don't get tripped up on all of these technicalities. But let's say somebody's starting that pressure washing business and they haven't got their LLC set up. They want to go down to Lowe's and start buying some equipment. What are some mistakes that people make when they're first starting a business? Let's say, you know, commingling of expenses. If you don't have the LLC and the LLC bank account set up, how can they get better with their bookkeeping and tracking of all this stuff ahead of time before they actually get the business fully launched?
Yeah, well, the IRS says you're required to keep books and records on any business. Anytime you want to start taking a deduction, you actually have to track it. So there's the tax standpoint, which says, we don't care what you are, you got to do this. So you want to have separate books for that business, period. From a risk standpoint, an asset protection standpoint, you're not going to get the benefit of an LLC or a corporation if you're still using your personal accounts and you're commingling. That's what they call piercing the veil. They're going to say it's an alter ego of you. And the very scenario you just gave is alter ego. It's like, hey, I didn't want to wait. I just wanted to go out and I'm going to start doing pressure washing. Okay. If you make a mistake, you're going to be personally liable. So my statement is always going to be, is it worth it? Is that risk worth it? Let's isolate the risk. It takes a couple of days, a few days, week to set up that LLC. Let's get it isolated. So even if you say, hey, you know what? I just want to run everything on my personal return. I don't care. I'm only going to make $20,000 a year doing this. It's not worth doing an S corp return and doing all that. I understand that. It's going in with your eyes open and saying, let's isolate that risk. The risk is that you're at a little bit greater risk of audit. And if you document things, we don't care about the audit, right? As long as you have things documented, we don't care. And you'll be part of that 6% that wins their audit because you have everything nice and tidy and you have your books and records. But my experience is most people who don't want to wait, don't keep books and records. They don't do any of that stuff. And when they're audited, they lose because they can't prove anything. They don't have any records. And by the way, it's your burden. Like, they're just going to say, hey, produce all your books and records of this business. And if you give them a personal bank statement, like, you're toast. They're going to say, how do I know what's business and what's personal? They're all mixed up. You're required to keep the who, what, where, when, and why for your expenses. That's your requirement as a taxpayer if you want the deduction. If you don't do it, you're not going to get the deduction.
All right. I got one more question. And then I know I've been bogarting the mic here, Ryan, but what about receipts? You know, we always hear, oh, you got to keep your receipts. But if you go, like, you have an LLC set up for the pressure washing business, you got a company credit card, you go down to Lowe's, you buy supplies, it goes into QuickBooks, and it's only a $100 charge. Do you have to keep that expense? Does it have to be registered? What is the IRS looking for in an audit to prove that Lowe's expense was actually for the pressure washing business? Or if it's a quick business meeting with a potential client, $50 lunch, like, does that really need to be a receipt that's captured? Or is there any other proof, or does that fall below the de minimis requirement?
The de minimis, I think, is $75, and that's for, like, meals and entertainment. I mean, not entertainment anymore. That's gone. But meals, there's some things where it says, hey, as long as you can tell me who, what, where, why, and when, I don't need the backup. Everything else, you need a backup. And when I say backup, you want a receipt to show that you actually made this expense and what was it for. Going through actual audits, I've been through super audits on payroll and 1099s, where if you're paying somebody more than $600 and you didn't get a W-9 on them and 1099 them at the end of the year, you're toast. They're going to hit you for 24% backup withholding, or they're going to disallow the deduction. So I know it sounds like it's a pain in the katush. Well, you know, if you're tracking in QuickBooks, just keep a receipt file someplace else. You don't have to, you know, get too crazy. You just want to have it there in the event that you're audited, and they can look back 3 years from the date that you file your return. So just get in the habit of keeping these things. And if you don't have it, my experience with audits is that they usually say, let me see your books and records. And if they can see that you're keeping QuickBooks, that's the end of the inquiry. They're taking a look-see to say, are they doing the kind of the bare minimum of what you're supposed to do as a business? Does it look and smell like a business, right? All right. Okay, good. We're good. So I've been through audits where, like, oh man, they're going to go, they might ask for two or three things and they're like, you're good.
Right.
And then you have the, hey, give me your books and records. And it's a dumpster fire.
This sounds like a lot like an oral on a check ride. You remember your private pilot check ride, you know, and if you're super buttoned up in the first three questions, it's like you just nail, you know, that check airman knows. They're like, all right, this girl knows their stuff. Let's go fly. And if you're missing things and you're like, I don't know. And then they are going to dig and dig and dig. So
that's it.
Yeah, I like that.
You just hit it on the head. And that's and where they dig is if you don't have it buttoned up. And when are you most likely not to be buttoned up? Sole proprietors, yeah. You know, what's the next level? LLCs that don't bother with compliance. What's the next level? Somebody getting too cute with a corporation. Maybe.
What do you mean by LLCs that don't keep compliance?
They set up an LLC, but they don't have a bank account in it. And they don't have books and records set up for it. They're just basically running everything out of their personal bank account.
Yeah.
So they have an LLC, but they didn't bother to separate the business from themselves. So they're really just themselves.
There it is.
Toby, I know you have a lot of really good YouTube channel content that hundreds of thousands of people have followed. If people want to continue down this road of learning what we discussed today, what is there a video that you put out that, like, continues going down the rabbit hole on any one of these things, sole prop, S-corp, C-corp, et cetera?
I've done a number where you could just say S-corp versus C-corp or LLC, S-corp. And I've done a few of them. I wrote a book too. It's still relevant. The tax laws have changed quite a bit as far as some of the amounts, but it's tax-wise business ownership. I think I've done four versions of it.
And I've read it. It's fantastic.
Okay, you've read it. So it breaks down each entity type and stuff, and you could use it kind of as a checklist. Those are easy. Maybe I'll do another video on small business again and put it up there so that your listeners have something to go to. But I mean, there's over 1,200 videos on the YouTube channel. That's just mine. You can go to Clint Coons too. And, you know, he's a little more real estate. Ben, but he's been my partner for close to 30 years, and he has a ton too.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot out of it.
I have too. It's an excellent YouTube channel, so definitely check it out. If you're thinking about starting a business and you're thinking, you know, entity structure, S-Corp, C-Corp, all this stuff, it's a wealth of knowledge. Order the book. I'm sure it's still on Amazon, the latest version at least. And the YouTube channel is just fantastic.
Thanks, Tate.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not blowing smoke. It's okay. It's amazing. I've spent
an
inordinate amount of time on your YouTube channel, Toby. So that's a real endorsement.
I appreciate that. Ryan, you didn't say anything nice, so.
I don't know. I wonder, what do you think? Do you think Clint's is better or do you think Toby's is better? I don't know.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, Toby, thank you so much for your time. This has been enlightening as always. We really appreciate you coming on and sharing your wisdom. One more time, how do people find out more about you and potentially work with your firm?
Just type in Toby Mathis or look at YouTube. And then come to our tax and asset protection event at Anderson Advisors. Again, I'll give you guys post a link. Every week we're teaching a tax and asset protection event where we go over the differences between LLCs, corporations, trusts, when to use them, what for, and some of the tax and legacy planning things that go along with it. And we love to teach. So there's a ton of content out there if you want to go dive in.
Wonderful.
Awesome.
Thank you again. We'll see you on the next episode.